You're listening to the Yeshiva of Newark podcast. I'm your host and curator, Rabbi Avram Kivalevich, and I hope you enjoy this episode. With downloads approaching the million mark and an archival library numbering in the thousands, the Yeshiva of Newark podcast has been striving to continuously upgrade our content, professionalize our audio sound, along with altering approaches in light of much appreciated listener feedback. I firmly believe the niche has been carved out that resonates with many on the wide spectrum of observant Jews. This explains why we continually rank high in independent online lists of top yeshiva podcasts. That proud edifice is in real danger of toppling and disappearing. We need the help of our listeners to continue to record and edit, to promote a product that has been a balm and instructor to so many. Just $36. As a minimum donation from 1,000 of you out there will keep us afloat as a Newark of straight, intelligent, humorous discussion, lectures, debate, and inquiry, while the destructive waters of ignorance and identity politics, cyberbullying, crash around us. Your generous contributions will seal and galvanize this ark till it comes to a satisfying rest in an era of Melea Ritzdeya, heralding Mashiach, B'mheira, B'yameinu, Amen. Shalom. This is Schmoozing with Rav Meir Schiller, Meir Einei Chachamim. Purim has always been more than just the days that it happened. It's more than just those events. It's obviously cast a very long shadow from its events to the future. And it's sort of indicated by a Gemara that we were talking about right before we started recording, the Gemara in Shabbos on Daf Peches, where after the Gemara discusses the fact that Klal Yisrael was makabel teira ba'oines at Matan Torah, the Gemara in Shabbos dealing with those sugyas that deal with the days right before Matan Torah, the Gemara says that the famous metaphor kof aleim har kigigis, that the Rabbeinu Shalom lifts up Har Sinai like a barrel, like a beer barrel, actually a gigis, and says, you know, im mikav mutav im lav shom tehei kuraschem, and I think the Gemara, as you mentioned before, it says Mikan Moidah Rabba Laraisa, that there was a sort of option out. A Moidah, of course, is a statement that a person can make by a get or other situations where he seems to be doing something and accepting something and being makabel something. The Moidah is sort of his excuse that he didn't really mean it. And this, of course, is the Moidah Rabba Laraisa, that we weren't really makabel the Torah fully and willfully. And that, you pointed out, the machlekes and gersoyes, whether it's rabba or rove, afal pikein, hodru kiblua bimei achashveirosh, that the kabbalas hatera occurred a second time, the time of achashveirosh. And I don't know if we want to go into exactly how Chazal extracted, but it is based on the pasuk that says kimu v'kiblu. And as rove's language is, kimu mashikiblu kval, which we all have understood to mean that from that moment there was a new Kabbalah Satera, and a Kabbalah Satera that is relevant for us, Bizman Azeh. We no longer have the Maidah, as I said to you before we started recording. We no longer have this out anymore. It's a Simcha Dika Kabbalah, but it now binds us even further. And this is what you referred to in a conversation we had yesterday as Kabbalah Satera Me'ahava, as opposed to the pachad and yira that was there in Matan Torah.
Rashi uses the phrase me'ahava sanes, me'ahava sanes. So some aspect of love going on here, and that validates the new Kabbalah.
Sort of Rashi's a little bit disappointing, isn't it? Right. In other words, it's like, okay, it was such a great nes. I mean, put it this way: on the heels of the nisim of Yitzias Mitzrayim, you probably can't get a greater nest than hearing the word of God speaking to you. But clearly there's a greater ava of this nes, the nes of Purim, the way I guess Rashi would understand it, than all the spectacular events from Yitzias Mitzrayim and Matan Torah.
Because Kof Alem HaKigigas invalidates those, it weakens those. The Kof Alem HaKigigas renders those insufficient.
I once wrote an article, I think when I was a teenager, comparing the Sefer Meshech Chochma's Rayonos to thoughts in other Chassidish form. And by the way, the Chassidim have published the Meshech Chochma, and they call him, you know, Hagoyin HaKodosh, Schusa Yogan Aleinu. They've adapted this very Litvish Godel, Rav Meir Simcha from Dvinsk.
No less confusing than their adoption of the Rambam.
Oh, well, yes. Well, it's one thing, you know, the Rambam, I think, can sort of be sort of calcified as from the Deiris HaKadmeinim.
Yes.
And as I mentioned in a couple of podcast episodes previously, how the Besht made Aliyas Neshama to the Heichal of the Rambam after he'd been the Heichal Tesis. But the Rambam, I could sort of understand. But Rav Meir Simcha was no fan of the Chassidim. You know, even though he appreciated Chassidish thinking, but there is the piece in Meshech Chochma right in the beginning of Hakdama to Sefer Shmois, which I found almost the same idea in the Bnei Yisoskar so many years ago. And that is Kofle Markigigas doesn't mean that there was like, you know, this mountain on top of Klal Yisrael. It meant that they were muchrach to accept because of the events of Yitzias Mitzrayim and Matan Torah. Kofle Markigigas means that how could they say no? They were taken up so totally and completely by the Nisim Gluyim and everything that was happening that I wouldn't say call it a mob mentality, but it was a mentality that didn't allow any doubt. Whereas he says what happened later was something that they had to perceive on their own and come to terms with and realize it in the human connection between events. It's still the same. The idea is essentially the exact same idea that we needed to go through the golus and pain and hester ponim of Purim to have a true Kabbalah that could keep us through the golus up until today. But I found the same idea in the Bnei Yisoskar. So I think it still indicates your point that Purim might be past for many of our listeners, but the Kabbalah Satera, the Kabbalah from Ava, the complete connection to the Rabbeinu Shalom that Purim has implanted within us and the responsibilities that we have is something that you wanted to talk about Kabbalah Satera Me'ava. And
yes, there's a tension which begins with Matan Torah between having to do and fulfill Hashem's will, because it's a commandment with grave consequences and grave meaning. And on the other hand, the preferred method of serving Hashem is to do it out of a sense of love, which entails and implies a sense of great pleasantness, etc. And this is a tension in every Jewish soul. It's a tension in every Jewish family with parents and children. And certainly it's a tension in every yeshiva and every mindset, boys and girls, the tension between demanding, requiring, having standards, having punishments, having consequences on the one hand, and on the other hand, seeking to implant this superior form of Avodas Hashem, which is Me'ahava. And if we might add, I think there's an empirical aspect to this, which is probably if the method employed is Me'ahava, it will tend to be more long-lasting. So if the goal of Chinuch is what is this fellow going to look like when he's 30, 40 years old, probably the stats would be better if it was originally implanted with a sense of love as opposed to a sense of utter and total coercion. So how we balance those two things is very important, and it becomes particularly intense today when the general social assumptions are that coerced behavior, coerced virtue is not so virtuous, and that coerced virtue can have negative repercussions. So we have this allgemeine attention, and on the other hand, we have particularly today with the hypersensitivity of young people, the hypersensitivity of society, we have this greater question of how we navigate it today.
We were speaking before we started recording when we were learning up the Gemara together that what the Gemara is actually saying is that all the Kiyama mitzvahs, and we're talking here about the glorious tkufa of Shlomo HaMelech, the tkufa of Chizkiyahu, the tkufa of Eliyahu HaNavi, that all of those were somewhat lacking. because the kiyum was missing. In other words, it wasn't just that the Kabbalah was faulty. Because the Kabbalah was faulty, all the kiyumei ha-mitzvahs up until that point were somehow lacking by the Rebbeinu Shlomo. The same way we have an excuse, and I mentioned this to you, and you appreciated this chop, I think. The same way, maybe that was how we got out of the gzeira of Harigas at the time of Haman, because Kadosh Baruch Hu couldn't hold us to Avodah Zarah if we had been mishtachavit to the Tselem in Nebuchadnezzar's time or agreed to that. Because our fealty was not an actual fealty, but it also discounts the glorious tkufas and bias rishon, because it makes it seem as if there's something missing in our Avodah Hashem. The kiyum is not a true kiyum. And I guess what I'm trying to push you this way is that if it's true, if we believe Chazal, that means that we have it. We do have that Kabbalah. So why isn't it translating? If we did have that Kabbalah and it was universal at the time of Purim, then why are we having such a hard time bringing it out? Why, as you just indicated, are we hitting the wall again, and we're seeing such facile and superficial acts of Kiyum HaMitzvahs and a lack of true Hislavos and Avodah and Hismasrus to the Rebbeinu Shlomo?
Right. Now, I would add one more point to these reflections, which I think is important to bear in mind. If we would be transported to pre-war Europe or pre-World War One Europe or pre-World War One Sephardic areas, or even back to the 50s and 60s here in America or in Eretz Yisrael, we would today regard their approach to being mechanech in Torah as overly strict, as overly demanding. And yet, most of the people that emerged from those years, and again, not all, but most of them, have a certain affection for the Magidishir and the Malamdim of that time, who used far more coercive methods than are used today. So that I'm not so sure if the Ahava was less in a tekufa of greater demands and discipline. I'm not discussing now, as we have discussed in the past, the standards of discipline. I'm just offering that there seems to be another element here in breeding the Ahava, as opposed to just being sort of soft and friendly and non-coercive. And we discussed also the fact that sometimes it's the figure of the mechanech, of the mashpia, that he can combine within himself perhaps the standard objective demands of earlier generations, but lurking under the surface, occasionally made explicit, is the ahava which lies under all of us. So that would seem to be sort of the optimum, to combine the amulaga demands and discipline with some form of either explicit or implicit ahava lying underneath it. So that is probably the ideal. And just add one further thought to that before we go on, and that is how to make that ahava explicit to some degree that it is grasped by students. And here you've got many different means. Today they offer them lots of rewards, many trips, many activities. But again, is that really what is indicated and demanded here? Or is there some very more real, subtle form of ahava which is needed?
So putting the onus on the instructors, on the teachers, on the melamdim, I believe that is the first place to start, and I agree with you. I shared with you earlier today a favorite Orachayim HaKodesh that also deals with this Gemara. And if I could just read a sentence which I think corroborates and I think deepens what we've been saying up until now. Many people have commented on this Orachayim, which is on Perek Yutes of Shmoyis Pasuk Zayin, that they said, well, isn't he basically just saying what the Medrash Tanhuma is saying, that Klal Yisrael wasn't yet makabel Torah Shebal Peh, that's what they needed the Koflim Harkigigas for. But actually, I really believe that all our listeners will gain by relishing some of the beautiful language that Rachaim, and I think he's saying a number of subtle points. But basically what he says, which I think is relevant to what we've just said, is that the reason why up until Purim, they sort of had a wait and see attitude towards what the rabbinical or Torah world or the leaders were doing was because I'm not sure, you know, is it something we can do? Maybe we cannot do. And who knows what they're going to demand from us. And it should be sort of almost democratic to who we accept it or not. They said, wait, you know, we're going to decide. Right? We'll wait. I'm okay with you guys, but we'll see. Each generation will decide whether this is something that they can vote yay for and accept. So therefore, the Torah Shebaal Peh and everything that's implied in the living according to Chazal was pretty much in doubt. He says, Ad Yemei Mordechai Sheroo Pu'ulas Chochom L'chaim. Such an interesting term. They saw that the leader, the Rosh Hashiva, the Manig, his actions were all about making life better for the Jews, saving them. That it was clearly, I care for you and I'm going to help you. And then he mentions it was Mordechai ve'Esther, and that created a acceptance sort of in our national consciousness to accept everything that will ever happen. Achar asher ro magodlu maisa hatzadikim. Shezulosim leyanisha roishem esanein shol Yisrael. So as you were saying, Rav Meir, I think that the idea of teachers as not just a noble, you know, profession, the ones that can't do teach, but teachers that radiate their every fiber of their being is the benefit of the Talmud or Talmidah, and that they are part of the national lifeblood of Klal Yisrael. If that is the way the teachers who give over the ideas and the Moyetzes or the Rabbonim or Mesaknim or Dayonim, if that is sort of what they carry with them, the attitude that permeates what they would like Klal Yisrael to be involved in, what they would Klal Yisrael to learn, then that is a continuation of that Kabbalah that occurred Bimei Achashverosh. So it's got to be more than just, this is a guy who's organized, who knows how to discipline a class. This is a guy who has some original ideas. There needs to be such a hismasrus.
You've jumped very quickly to original ideas, but I want to just step back a moment here and talk about, you're talking about what he exudes. And I think you said, he presents an orderly shear, but I think there's two aspects to the transference of Ni'imus. The first aspect is he must be an experiencer himself of the Ni'imus. So to the degree that he is invigorated by the presentation of whatever aspect of Torah that it is, he has to show a model of really desiring, loving, caring for clarity in the material which he has presented. If he comes late to shir or comes late after recess or whatever that might be, he's already destroyed the entire message that he wishes to give over, which as this is geschmack, let's get to it. I quoted for you yesterday that Lombardi used to yell at the Packers who came later than 10 minutes earlier for practice, that showed a disinterest. There's a Zman. You must be before the Zman if you really care. So I think any Malamed has to embody that.
To balance both of these, to be Pu'ulas Chochem L'chaim, many times these visionaries aren't so great at the details, right? They're all about Klal Yisrael, and let's go do this to show our connection to the whole Jewish people. Right. And yet, like you say, the subject matter suffers. And then you have these fuss budgets, I would say, who are almost anal in the way they present their material and how there cannot be any sort of aberration from the way they've done it year in and year out. So you're correct that if a person doesn't care enough, and you're right, comes late and doesn't have his thoughts organized and isn't able to sketch out for people who haven't learned it yet, these are the great steps to get it. He shows a lack of love of the material. But again, you can always fall into the trap of being so in love with the material that you're not really seeing beyond it.
And you're not seeing to what degree the audience sitting in front of you is grasping it.
Exactly.
Which is, I think, a frequent flaw that, you know, the Lama, the Rebbe, gets focused on the good kids who are getting what he's saying and loses track of the others who are not. So in terms of the application of the sweetness curriculum or the Me'ahava, Be'ahava curriculum, I thought we could split it up into four separate categories, each of which must be understood. The first is the man himself, that the mashpia has to exude a certain sweetness, friendliness, positive, pleasant demeanor. That's number one. Number two, he has to infuse the material with that. In other words, he's got to come in and say, oh, today this Tosfos is going to be so geschmack. It's going to be hard. We're going to have to make charts and diagrams. But trust me, when it's all done, it's going to be very, very sweet. And you're going to be able to taste the Tom of Torah in it. And then I thought of the two other categories, which are the out-of-classroom happenings. One is the out-of-classroom religious event, sudas, mesibas, nigunim, rikudim, which that is also very important in this process. But here I add a cautionary note that I think there has to be a chinuch in what those things are. They're just hopping and bopping to high decibel music or contemporary high decibel singers. That's not what we mean. We have to mechanech them in what is true joy. And true joy is evoked by mesibas and zmiras and so on and so forth. And here I add this famous slonim of haboicha b'shir zimra. You can see if the zimra is the way it should be by the fact that the shirei zimra, the shiraim of the zimra, does it make the next day's learning and davening better? That's a good test for that. And finally, I added doing other things together with them, not overtly religious. And that is in some ways also a good way to explain the aspect of Ahava, in that if, while doing other things, one imbues those things with a religious sensibility, that is also very effective. And finally, P.S. to all of it, I think that just a good vort here and there, you know, as you walk by them, just a joke, a vettel, some reference to them, I think is very important. And again, P.P.S., doing things for them, getting them gifts, doing favors for them in their own lives. I think that this PPS is also very important. So those are all methods that can be employed to emphasize the Ahava aspect. But if you're missing any one of them, if it's just, you know, high decibel music, or it's just a Rebbe making a lot of jokes or whatever that might be, it's not going to have the proper effect. It needs the whole package.
The Purim experience with the Rebbe might be a way to sort of begin or open up or expand that sort of Ahava connection to their students. I'm not talking about necessarily elementary school students who visit their Rebbe and bring Shalach Manos and get a knip on the bekel and a dollar. I'm talking about high school and above who actually spend the Suda with their Rebbe and are able to see elements of simcha and joy and connectiveness. And I think those type of touchstone events that could actually, although you might not have that Rebbe the next year, but having a Rebbe that you feel you can come to their home and be taken by a wave of happiness and feeling kedusha of the Suda, I think that is almost like a perfect way to jumpstart that type of relationship, wouldn't you say?
Yes, and I offer here a thought that I once heard on a tape from Rabbi Yaakov Meir Schechter, and he said that a Magid Shia spends endless hours preparing what he's going to say by the Shia. He says, Kol Sheken v'kal v'choyma, a father in his home, or let's say a Rebbe who's having Talmidim over, how much time he should invest in having the appropriate Veta and Sipurim and Kedoyma, that Suda Shabbos is more of a demanding chinuch moment than how many mafarshim we can speak out by the shir. So I remember he made that point. It's a very telling point that one must prepare, although obviously it shouldn't appear forced, but one must think what I'm going to talk about, what are we going to discuss, what's going to be on the table here in Torah and Ander and Yonim.
It's sort of hard for me not to throw in another little knetch. We said before that it was either Rabba or Rava who said, Hadar Kiblua Abimei Achashverosh. And of course, Rava is the man d'omer in Megillat Avzayin and Bebeis, who says, Machai v'nish v'psumei v'puria adva yoda ben arham and l'barach mordchai. So the idea of a Sudas Purim that can somehow take you to a whole different place, a place where, and again, I'm not in any way advocating for children to be imbibing intoxicating drinks, but it becomes like an amazing event. Purim, by whatever, how you ever understand Libsume, it's something special. It's something unique. It's something that is not run-of-the-mill and every day. And I believe it taps into that Kabbalah that we were talking about, that Kabbalah of Klal Yisrael. We talk about how do you activate it again. I think Rava understood that it could be activated in the Sudas Purim. Through the drinking, through the merriment, through the simcha of everyone's connection with you. Once again, it isn't something that was just in the sands of history. We can touch it and feel it and embrace it every single year. You might have to do something intense. I appreciate what you're saying in terms of how you have to prepare, especially if you're having students over and you know there's a certain student who needs a little more kiruv than the other. And if you want to say over a beautiful vart in the Megillah or a chap in Hilchas Kriyas HaMegillah, you should choose the one that you think will inspire the most. But I believe that once you set the plate, what the students get carried over with is not what you prepared, but it's the spontaneity and the reality that wasn't prepared. I think that's where they fall in love, and they also are able to say, I want to be like that. This is the memory that is embedded in that person that he now brings throughout his life, that type of event. Just to say one other chap, even if you want to say that it's a rabba who said that, right? We know the next Gemara is, Kam rabba v'shachte l'rab zeira. The Gemara right after that, Kam Rabba v'shachte l'Rab Zeira, the Gemara Dav Zayin Mebeis in Megillah. I love the pshat that another person that the Chassidim have elevated as their own, Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz, says that Kam Rabba v'shachte l'Rab Zeira, it doesn't mean that he actually took a knife and as he was wanting to cut up the flanken, he took the knife and sliced this fellow's throat, Rab Zeira. But Shachte means that Rabba unleashed the full power of his learning. In other words, normally, I think I sometimes experience it when I speak with you and others, that you can tell people are holding back. They don't have to necessarily be completely 100% on. They listen. They're careful. On Purim, the amount of drink that Rabba had allowed him to sort of throw off those shackles of inhibition in learning, and he schmattered him. He was so like a steamroller, he shechted him. In other words, Reb Zeira, who we know later has a glorious history in Eretz Yisrael, but at that point was a little bit unsure of where he was holding and learning. And Rab, instead of that chavershav that usually is employed, the learning went to the ninth degree. What could happen at a Purim Suda is that it's almost like Torah's uncorked. It's unplugged, and it becomes so powerful that it could actually, again, it could give chalishas hadas to people that are around you. And that's the shachte v'Rab Zeira.
Nigunim also have the ability. What is a nigun? Somebody once said, it's the old kutzkavot of all of Avchem that we place the words upon their heart, and if the heart opens, the word falls in. So nigunim are the methodology to cut open the heart so that the veta should be able to penetrate. So not just libisuma, but stam nigunim as well. The opening of the soul, which you refer to, is available in a sense by drink. Drink is also a means to cut open the heart and to allow things to enter. Now again, for those of you who are listening to this and saying, oh, that's terrible. How can that be? Again, okay, fine. I'm not advocating people should be taken to hospitals and so forth. But I am advocating, in many cases, for a sense of taking the mitzvah in its simplicity. To whatever degree, machlokes or poskim on this goes back 1,000 years, more than 1,000 years. But on the other hand, we should not forget that the human soul needs to be opened. We need to allow things to penetrate deeply. And the combination of nigunim and drink and conviviality is a tremendous means to that. Although I will add here sort of the party pooper that I added once as far as the slichas that are often done on the first night of slichas. They've now sort of converted the first night of slichas into a hopping, bopping, feasting event lasting hours. I will simply add that if one is doing Purim kidaboya, then one is not going to miss Maariv or Sofsmai Krishma the next day or davening with Minyan the next day. So again, the Shirei Zimra, we can see to what extent it was what it should have been.
It's interesting that you mention the power of Zemer throughout the year and on Purim specifically, when the Sudas HaChashverosh, which is described in such detail in the first parak of Megillas Esther, you know, you almost have all the senses dealt with. There's taste and touch, but we don't hear anything about the sounds. We don't hear anything about any music being played there. Now, again, how much do the ksuvim have to indicate? But I think it's something that there isn't any description. And I think that might be, in a way, a sort of a tikkun, as we say, to Achashverosh Suda. In other words, the tikkun Achashverosh Suda is what's that, what was missing. There is no kli zemer. So that's where we could actually insert whether we actually take out guitars and pianos or not, but the singing is in a way something which isn't there, because I think part of what singing does also, Reb Meir, it's also in a way, although it can be done in a very formalized way, but it also lends itself to an outpouring of soul in a pure form that just sitting there and, you know, and eating and drinking doesn't. Eating and drinking many times becomes a completely self-absorbed act, relishing what's going down your gullet. Whereas singing, you, especially if other voices join you, you feel a bond and a connection that you don't have otherwise.
But it needs achana. I want to reemphasize what I said before. It needs a certain achana. It needs a certain teaching of what nigunim and rikudim should be. So again, I just repeat a pet peeve of mine. I don't know if turning up the decibels is what is needed. It's a greater reflection and teaching about what nigunim are. And if that's there, then the decibels can be a lot lower, I think.
100%. Although, you know, in many ways, the figure in our time that sort of stands as the architect of decibel raising in many ways, or nigunim, they're just easy to pick up, almost inanely repeating till an absurd place, is Carl Bach. You know, Carl Bach.
Decibel value? No.
Again, Carl Bach does have some beautiful soft songs, but many of the nigunim, you know, Carl Bach sets the stage for, whether it's, whether it's Simcha Artzecha, or others, which are great nigunim sung softly, but they are easy nigunim to be picked up. And I think what happens is, and then you know, you have Shmelki's Nigun and others that people have propagated throughout these last 30, 40 years. And you don't have the idea of just sitting back and hearing a knetch, a melody, like you have in Moshitz and some of the other Chassidish Nigunim. It's sort of like an easy Nigun to pick up, and then it just repeats itself. And then, you know, everybody can just, like 100 bottles of beer on the wall, right? You know, in other words, it's very easy. You hear it 2 or 3 times. Okay, now I'm ready to just, you know, to join in the chorus. And I think
the repeating sometimes, repeating a tenua or repeating certain words, it is a means to allow the meaning of the words to penetrate.
Right, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about how sometimes, and even the tune, and the repetition of the tune sometimes crushes and like sort of expunges the words, because you sing that niggin over and over again. But it is definitely a talent that needs to be brought out. And sometimes you have to realize that you're not ready. Maybe right now you're the audience listening to the Menagin. Eventually, perhaps you'll learn how to sing that niggin and you'll learn how to join in properly.
From a spectator sport to a participatory sport.
Yeah, the bridge is there, but you say, you need the training and you need to have the discipline to be able to manage it. I'd say one other thing. One of the things I noticed in halacha, especially at the end of Hilchos Megillah in the Shulchan Aruch, is the Rama talking about all the wild games and shtikarai and Mine Hezek and other things. And many times when I teach this to the modern audience, they're so surprised that they would go out and joust and they would dress in this, right, in outlandish ways, and they would jump around. And so one thing that needs to be remembered is that there was a repression that was basically the standard in most of the European communities. Purim was the one day that things can be loosened. Otherwise, life was difficult, hard. It was regimented. And Purim, since it was so unregimented, it meant so much. And therefore, I think the Chachamim and others allowed the excesses because they needed to have a release at least sometime.
Yes, and the further development in Chosh Mishpat and elsewhere, that there might be exemptions from Tashlum and for the Hezek, right, which is done during these times, is truly fascinating.
Right.
I once heard from a hockey player who was very into practical jokes with his teammates, and he said to me, there were always a few guys on the team that he would never do a practical joke with them because they didn't have the friendliness and the conviviality that you needed for the joke to accomplish its tachlis, which was to remove the havdalah from one player to another. So he said he always avoided them when it came to practical jokes, because practical jokes is based upon a certain liebschaft amongst the players. So the same thing over here on Purim, that if there's a person who has no shaychus to the liebschaft that we're trying to achieve, so with him it's best anish to chefen.
In other words, nothing is humorous. The person takes himself so seriously that he assumes any sort of humor that might be construed at his expense, like an assassin trying to, he needs to sort of, in self-defense, needs to smack back with his hockey stick.
Or his anger, or just his anger, yes.
Yeah, what I was trying to say, though, is that the 21st century American boy or North American boy or girl or community, we have such freedom, we have such laxity that we don't need Purim to have that. Purim was so necessary in periods of extreme devotion and constraint, either from the community itself or based on our relationship with the non-Jews around us. Here, you know, you could go to ball games, you could hang out in pizza shops, you could dance around and dance in the streets and do whatever you want throughout the year. So therefore, Purim, I think, has lost a lot of that necessity. And because of that, it's lost its specialness. You could do that type of shtickerai any day, really.
Yeah, I just want to say, when you said the word repression before, I think the better word is restraint, that the Amulege Welt had greater restraint. Somebody once had an interesting thought, which is pictures of families, pictures of individuals, the further back in history you go, the less they are smiling. The less they are smiling, the post-Civil War family picture is, they're never smiling. It's always very serious.
Yeah, well, part of that was the way photographs were done in those days.
That's true.
They had to stand still for right. for an hour.
You can't get to smile that long. But even later, I think, even though it's Tom Butler, I think it was Mitikayim, because people wanted the lasting image of themselves not to be flippant. So that today, the Ganze Welt, certainly in North America and Western Europe, is decidedly always flippant. So therefore, you're saying the Purim flippancy has to be to some degree different in order to make a ratio.
And I think that's why it's sort of redundant. And I think that's another reason why in the modern Orthodox world that you mentioned before, not only is drinking discounted, but also in a way the whole
the release and specialty of Purim is discounted. It's so antiseptic in the modern Welt,
yes,
to the point anyone who's really been in the yeshiva world and gone to the Rebbe, like we were discussing,
right,
is going to find his sojourn in the modern Orthodox Purim world to be artificial.
Antiseptic.
Yes. And I think what it gets replaced by is inventiveness of costume, right?
Yeah.
You know, which you think about it, especially if it does herald from, you know, the French aristocrats who had all their costume balls. You know, I think about, you know, the Mask of the Red Death from Edgar Allan Poe's short story of, you know, these right, costume balls where people are dressed as various images. It's not what I would call the spontaneous avas ish esrayeu and avas hatayra. It's I got to get a costume and I've got to work it out. And which figure are you dressed like? That I think the modern Welt accepts because it's not dangerous. Many times the costume, you talk about repressed or restrained. When you're in costume, sometimes the costume can allow your real self to come out because you're afraid or you're repressed or restrained. But I think what happens in the modern Welt is that the person is almost like a Madame Trousseau mannequin wearing the costume at the ball.
Yeah, no, I would agree completely. And I would always add here the cautionary note that when one enters into the right of the modern Welt, let's say the Chadal Welt in Eretz Yisrael, or more YUE-based medrash types in America, that this critique that you're voicing is not relevant so much. It's relevant to those that are more cut off from normative Torah life. There, that's where it becomes more relevant. But I suppose in some West Bank Chadal Yishuv that Purim is ganz fine.
Oh, yeah, 100%. When again, you know what I mean when I say I say modern Orthodox, I'm talking about Teaneck, I'm talking about Skokie, I'm talking about the places that I've lived in, that I've experienced, and I think part of it is a discomfort with Purim, a discomfort with a spontaneity because it's scary in a way. And let me just say one other thing here: when we talk about being intoxicated by a personality, I think that there's become a fear of the influence of teachers. Part of what modern Orthodox schools do by making sure that the Rabbeim are all split up, like, you know, you have one Rebbe who's, it seems like it's just a way to spread the wealth around. But what they do is, in many of the schools, you have one Rebbe, the Gemara, and then you have a different Rebbe for Tanakh, a different Rebbe for another subject, and the Rabbeim are sort of like plugged in to subjects, as opposed to this is your Rebbe who's giving you everything this year. He's the fount of knowledge in every aspect. And what that does is, on the surface, the administrators will tell you this is a way for the student to be exposed to different viewpoints. But I think what the reason why the parents are happy is because they don't necessarily want there to be some sort of what they are scared of, which is like some sort of Svengali or Rasputin figure that's somehow going to dominate and change the mindset of their child.
Right. No, I agree with you completely on that. Also, again, they are very much influenced by how the wind blows in the outside world, and there's always the fear of authority figures and the fear of worse, what can happen. And so whatever the way the wind is blowing outside, they're certainly going to stick their finger in the air and follow those winds. But let's return to more pleasant notions here if we can.
Right. I'm not just trying to bash the modern Orthodox institutions and their parents, but when we talk about why Kabbalas HaTorah B'Ahava is a difficult thing to achieve despite the truth of what Chazal are telling us, is because if you are limited in your Shemesh Talmid HaChachamim, if the Gemara Shir is just an hour and 15 minutes, and that's your interaction with this figure of Talmudic thinking, which is really Jewish thinking, which is really Torah thinking, then it's going to be hard to live with that. It's a subject.
And all moments of great enthusiasm, quote unquote, which they do allow, their Shiriyas and their Chagigas and all that stuff, becomes essentially empty prolic. And that is sort of what they're left with, having tried to lessen the gravity of the things you're talking about. They have to provide something. A human being must live. People have to live. So they provide these empty culinary activities, which are not yielding any very much except just more fun. As a final thought, I know that the Sefer Rebbe Zichron Livracha would always say the Shabbos before Purim. He would quote the Mama Chazal, the Halacha, and he said this applies not only B'gashmias, but it applies B'ruchnias as well. Whatever we ask from the Ribbono Shel Olam on Purim, he's much more apt to give to us on Purim. And just as our Kabbalah's HaTorah Me'ahava is what validates our practice of Torah, it unleashes also these divine hashpahs, which Purim uniquely possesses. So if you're listening to this after Purim, then any acceptance of Torah, the Me'ahava, can probably evoke the same sense of chasadim from above.
Very beautiful. Yeah, we'll talk about being poishet yad towards what you wanted. I remember something that happened when I was, this is going back 50 years ago, when Purim morning, when I had already started the Ad Lo Yod experience, I think our friends had somehow brought the contraband of Southern Comfort whiskey into the dormitory in Ner Yisrael. And we started sipping right after Krios HaMegillah. And I noticed as I was sort of wandering around in a Southern Comfort stupor, one of the Choshev fellows in the yeshiva who, at that point, they would put the best of the students on the special head table in the dining room where the best guys would sit. And this was someone that I knew.
Mesibas Balagaiva.
Yeah, it was the place where you made the head table, you were something really special. We would sort of wait, who's at the head table from year to year? Like who was able to get that seat and who refused the seat? So one of the head table nicks, who was known to be a great Talmud Chacham, a person who could explain any piece of Gemara clearly and solidly, but I had passed him often and he had never even acknowledged my existence in any way. So somehow on Purim, I was able to feel that I ran over to him when I passed him. I grabbed him and I said, Reb Pliny, you're so great in Torah. You're a head table guy, but you never say anything to us. We're just these high school young kids. How come you never speak with us? How come you never are connected to us? How come when I pass you, you don't say hello? I don't know how it came out of me, but obviously this was something that meant a lot. And I have a distinct memory that later that day, as sipping more and more at the yeshiva's mesiba, as I found myself sort of like drooping and dropping, and a hand picked me up, lifted me, and started dancing with me so strongly. And this was this fellow before. And I have heard that, and I don't want to claim that it had anything to do specifically with my request, but he has become a great teacher in Klal Yisrael. He's someone that Talmidim always tell me understands their issues, is able to speak with them with understanding and give great seichel and advice. People have stayed within his influence for years. Purim, I think, Rav Meir, Dafka, because it can allow you to do something otherwise you would find awkward and difficult, to somehow reach behind the mask and be able to talk to a person in a stark, real way that can perhaps change you and change them. And it's something that I think that it's harder to do when Purim's over. But I think Purim teaches us the importance of being able to do that.
Abaycha b'shirei zimra. We should be zochet to abaycha b'shirei zimra, the shiraim of the zimra.
Yes, yes. Thank you for sharing, for allowing your song to permeate within this platform. Take care. Be well. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you liked what you heard. If you did,
please take a moment to share this or any of the many episodes available on our platform with friends in order to help grow our community. Until next time, Shalom.